as I'm going through it, underlining how where it started, I write in the notes next to, in the margins next to Bill's story, how I relate to Bill's story. So next to where he says he was in the service, there I was in the gas station. And so, and you'll see as you go through Bill's story, there's a progression of his drinking. This is where it started. You know, this is my life with alcohol when it just seemed to be the way, you know, when it was important to me, right? And it, and somewhere around the, page 4, it starts to take a turn and decline until he hits this bottom on page 8. So there's this curve. And if I can relate to Bill's story and underline a lot and make little notes in the margins all the way through, hopefully what I've ended up with is this is where my drinking started. This is what happened to it, right? And then this downturn near the end of my drinking and how much I tried to stop. See, it's going to be hard to see the depth of my hopelessness when I focus on how much I enjoyed drinking and how much I drank. Right? I have to at some point get to the point where I have to see that it got to the point in 1987 where I made some firm commitments that I was going to drink differently. Right? This has to stop. It stopped the drugs, but for the next 2 years, I found myself walking to the liquor store over and over again, baffled by why I was still doing it. Right? Because there's a question that has to be asked. Is why is it if I see that I had consequences for how much I drank, why did I keep drinking? Why did I keep going in spite of losing businesses and trashing relationships and marriages, actually? You know, why knowing that that it was affecting my life, why was it still so? Why couldn't I change the way I was living? You know, I'd go to sleep telling myself, I've got to stop doing this, and before I'd even open my eyes in the morning, just as I'd wake up, the first thought that would come to my mind was, when am I going to get up and walk to the liquor store and get some more whiskey? Right? And that situation went on for the next 2 years, that kind of thinking, where I found myself talking out loud, walking to the liquor store, just going, why do I keep doing this? So somewhere around page 8, some of that stuff should come up as you're going through Bill's story. The second half of Bill's story, page 9 through 16, will basically outline his program of recovery. And you can actually identify all the 12 steps in that section. Just the basic ideas of it. And so There's a great description of three different types of drinkers on page 20, where it talks about the moderate drinker, the hard drinker, and the real alcoholic. Because the moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. I see that wasn't me. Right? When I came to the point where I absolutely knew that I had to stop living like this, right? I couldn't stop. It says then we have the certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate. Although he may find it difficult or troublesome, and may even need medical attention. Right? There's people that medical attention will actually help. You know, the in a lot of meetings that I go to, they want to bash recovery programs. But hopefully they filter out the people that don't need us, right? The people that they can help. The fact was that none of that stuff, ill health, falling at my wife, the changing environment, warnings of the doctor, there was nothing that I could change in my life that would change the way I was drinking. And I tried. You know, I closed the factory down. I stopped hanging around certain people. I eliminated all this stuff out of my life, thinking that if I just get this out of my life, then my life will change. Till finally, the only thing left was her, so it must be her fault. So I kicked her out. Right? You know, she was so nice when I met her. I don't know why she got so crazy. I know now why. It was living with me. Uh-huh. I drove her that way. She just was baffled by the turn that her life took as a result of the turn that my life took. I think but what about the real alcoholic? He may start off a moderate drinker, and I did. And he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Right. So now I see that I can relate to that part of it. Right? That I could not start drinking and know really what was going to happen. Right. And hopefully, if I've attached all the experiences up to this point, in looking over with the physical idea in mind, and how alcohol affects me, it brings us to a summary. And after each section that I look at with step one, it'll summarize that in the last paragraph. And where I see a shift from the physical allergy to the mental obsession is at the top of page 23. So the last paragraph that I look at in referring to the physical craving is, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the body and mental sense which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Right? And I have to be clear on this moving on. Just does my experience abundantly confirm that I can't start drinking without consequence, without losing control? Right? And I saw that, and it's, again, I got to separate what's going on in my mind with that. I look back at the history of the trash businesses and the trash marriage and see how it's attached to how much I've drank and how I was living, right? My experience abundantly confirmed that alcohol was impacting my life at a deep level, right? It was confused by those times when I did go out and have a drink with somebody and didn't have consequences. And the delusion that I can control it was strong. And was so sure that one day I would straighten my life out. But the fact is that day never came, and I never really knew when I would drink to the point of consequence. Right? I had no control over when that would be. Right? So that section ends with a summary, and the next section for the mental part will start with a question. This question has to get answered in this next section. These observations would be academic and pointless, which means they're good to know. But if you never took the first drink, thereby setting that cycle in motion. I'm sorry. Let me read that again. These observations would be academic, meaning it's good to know, but it's pointless if you just never take that first drink, right? Therefore, thereby setting that terrible cycle in motion. So that brings up the question, Why is it when I saw that alcohol was such a consequence in my life and caused so many problems, why didn't I just stop drinking? Right? It says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in my mind rather than in my body. And this sentence gets so pulled out of context. Right? And I'm going to get back to that. Okay? Because we're still in the first half of step one. We're not even in the second half of step one yet. My experience with that story I started to tell is that I'd go to sleep telling myself I've got to stop drinking like this. And I'd wake up and the first thing that would come to my mind is when am I going to get up and walk to the liquor store? And I'd take that long one block walk to the liquor store talking to myself out loud. I mean, what's wrong with me? Why do I keep doing this? Right? And I would yell at myself, argue with myself. What's wrong with you? And I believed that I had such a strong will, and it was true, I did. Right? But for some reason, it wasn't there when it came to the drinking situation. Now, you got to remember the times were different. This was 1987, and it meant something completely different when somebody was walking down the street yelling at themselves. Now you just assume they're on their Bluetooth. Right? In 1987, it meant something different, which was more accurate. It meant they were crazy. Right? So to go along with the idea that therefore the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body, right? I could see that. I could see that I had a mind that just kept wanting to throw alcohol on it. And you get people in the program that wants to tell you, well, today I just choose not to drink. I wonder what the choice was when someone with time drinks. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reason yet obscured, have lost the power of choice in drink. Where so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent, we are unable at certain times to bring into our own consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. I went 2 years in that place, baffled. I knew the truth. I knew that I had to stop drinking, but completely baffled by my inability to stop drinking. Not everybody experienced what I'm talking about. Some people get stopped quicker. I just happened to be in a situation that... I kept myself in a situation where nobody really had control or any influence on my life. I was managing where I was living. As I said, I wasn't paying rent. Threw the wife out, got her out of the way because I knew that it wouldn't be so bad if she wasn't nagging me like she was. I was basically on this path to just continue as I was. And nothing externally was in place to stop me. I had a regenerating bank account every month. I had rents come in. And mind you, I didn't own the building. So I know it sounds good, but it wasn't my building. The next paragraph on page 24 after that choice paragraph talks about thinking it through. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. That's one of the first definitions of insanity for me in the book. The failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. You know, I must have been about 4 or 5 years old when I got a bunch of extension cords, right? And I, for some reason, got the idea that I was going to plug them, a bunch of extension cords into outlets and then connect them in the middle, right, with some scissors. That experience left me in a place with deep respect for electricity. You know, I never had the urge to do that again. Right? But when it came to alcohol and what it was doing to my life, right, that same ability to, that same mental defense just wasn't there. Right? And as I said, it went on for years. So my drinking took me to the place where I absolutely was baffled and consigned myself to the idea that I was just going to keep drinking until I was dead. I hadn't actually heard about Alcoholics Anonymous before. I didn't know what I was going to do. I started seeing a therapist. Again, I'm not bashing therapists. I think some of them can be really helpful. It's just a good idea to find someone that knows something about alcoholism, right, who's AA friendly. And I think it's important to not do things in AA to make them dislike us so that they can refer us to AA. And I don't know if it happens here in Canada, but a lot of people will badmouth therapists in meetings in where I come from. Not really conducive for them to refer people to us, right? You know, there is more and more I'm being made aware of programs where they're trying to familiarize new therapists with what we can do, right? And I think we have to be careful not to do anything to mess up that situation. And you know, but it is advisable to find someone that is familiar with what the options are for people who are recovering. My particular choice, AA never came up. We've all probably read the story of the jaywalker, right? And that always had a really profound impact on me. In fact, I don't know if anybody's ever been to the website thejaywalker.com. That was mine. That's mine. It's got a bunch of odd stuff that I've written. So if you ever move to go look, you're welcome to do that. But it says, our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink, as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. This is on page 37, by the way. On the bottom of 38, I want to make a mention of this. It says, you may think our illustration too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit that if we substitute alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. So why don't we substitute alcoholism for jaywalking? Whoops. If I can keep the page. Okay. He gets a thrill out of hanging out at bars. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and then he goes on benders several times in succession. You would expect him, if he were normal, to just cut it out. But presently he gets drunk again, and this time ends up in a recovery program. Within a week after leaving the hospital, he gets drunk again, with more complications, more consequences. He tells you he's decided to stop drinking for good, but in a few weeks he's back drinking on another bender. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promise to be careful or to keep out of bars altogether. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce. He's held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the drinking idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways, or a rehab, right? But the day he comes out, he races back to the bar, which sets off another spree. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Right? But that was me. Right? Over and over again, hanging out at bars, drinking, having consequences, consequence after consequence. Right? You know, and crazy? I absolutely believe that that's where I was. So I look at the mental obsession from the top of page 23 to the bottom of 43. So listen, here's what the last paragraph on 43 says. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Right? There was nobody that could stop me from drinking once that idea hit my mind. There was nobody that could stand between me and that bottle. Right? If they tried to, I would get them out of my life. So that's the first half of step one. And I ask a question here. Chewing ice is probably coming through the microphone, isn't it? Sorry.
The question?
Yeah, I got sidetracked there for a minute. Why is it that after I'd get a few days away from drinking, when the consequences were great enough that I'd say, enough, I can't take it anymore. And for some reason or some way, I'd get 3 days or 4 days. Or why is it that people come into recovery and they'll get 30 days or 60 days, right? Or 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, and all of a sudden they drink again, right? Too many people hang on the idea of, as I said before, that the problem centers in my mind, right? What I have to see is there's something else going on here, right? There's the second half of step one that I have to understand. I have to understand what is the condition conducive for those obsessions to return, right? That would be important to know, even with time in the program, right? You think those people that drank with 30 years of sobriety thought that they were going to be the one to drink? No, they thought it was going to be that other guy, right? The guy that never drinks, probably. Right? It's important to understand certain things. One is, why is this a spiritual problem? What is a spiritual solution, and what do I have to have that effect? Right? Because when the obsessions hit me, there was no calling anybody for help. Like your sponsor, like I didn't have a sponsor at the time when I was drinking, but you know, there was nobody I would have thought of calling at the time. There was, you know, when that obsession hits, I'm drinking, right? And so I have to understand what is it that sets that up. And let me just check this timing here. 8:30, 9:30, okay. Which leads us into the second half of step one. And I use page 52 a lot through this process. I use it in the first step, the second step, and the third step, and again in the 11th step. All right. So let's go to page 52, where it says we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. Right? They're asking me to change my point of view towards my human problems, just like they've asked me to change my point of view towards my alcoholism. Initially, I thought my alcoholism was a problem that was, the problem was out here in the consequences of my drinking, that my problem with alcohol was the consequences, right? But what it's talked about so far in the book is the idea that I have a mental obsession that sets up a condition that takes me to that first drink, and then I lose control, right? That's much different than what I thought was really going on, right? I just thought if I rearranged my outside situations that I wouldn't have to drink, right? But they're talking about a problem that's going on inside of me. So Nair is asking me to look inside for my other human problems, to change my point of view. It says we were having trouble with personal relationships. Was I having trouble with personal relationships? Not just love relationships. I was having trouble with family. I was having trouble with my customers in my business. I had trouble with friends. Right? It says we couldn't control our emotional natures. Right? And I saw that I couldn't control my emotional natures. But at a deeper level, when I started to understand what they mean by the nature of it, not just my emotions, the way I differentiate between those two is I show you the emotions that I want you to see, right? But you don't see what's underneath, what's inside of me, and that's my emotional nature, is the part of my emotions that are inside of me, not what you're seeing. And it's the part that's inside of me that I can't control, right? Says we were prey to misery and depression. Right? Are you vulnerable to misery and depression? Right? You know, the times when you don't want to answer the phone and you keep the drapes closed and I can't just get myself out of that. I can't just talk myself out of that. Right? All the mirror work in the world's not going to change that for me. You know what mirror work is, right? Yeah. You look in the mirror and smile at yourself and tell yourself how great you are, right? You know, that doesn't work. That kind of stuff doesn't work for me. Couldn't make a living, right? I never had a life that I was satisfied with. Right. There was times that I had money, and there was times when the relationship seemed good, but she was never good enough. The money was never good enough. The car was never good enough. Right? I never had a way of life that was comfortable or that was enough. So we had a feeling of uselessness. Right? I wasn't really thinking about too many other people at the time, so that didn't stand out as a glaring problem, but looking back, I see that I was pretty useless, and that's something that could come up later on, really, when you're in the further down the line here in the program, because sometimes people that read this for the first time with time in the program, right, feeling useless in the program. Says we were full of fear. You know, fear pretty much steered the course of my life. Right? It was the thing that stopped me from painting that picture or writing that book or going back to school and doing the things that something inside told me I just wasn't going to be able to accomplish. Says we were unhappy. I was certainly unhappy near the end of my drinking, right? And couldn't seem to be of real help to other people, right? Now, I definitely related to those things when I was new. Now, another problem, though, is with time and with experience, sometimes you can go back to this and relate to those things again, right? time does not necessarily save you from this condition. All right? What I had to see was is that these are outlining outward manifestations of a spiritual malady. They aren't the spiritual malady, right? But they're the result of a spiritual malady. Because my spiritual malady is transparent. I don't see it. It's deep down inside of me. What comes out of me is problems with personal relationships, can't control my emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, all these things. That's what's out here, right? It's a sign. If you can relate to these, it's a sign, okay? But the good news is there's a cure for it. There's something you could do that we can find in this book that will take you out of that place. Right? Just want to throw that out there. So nobody doesn't want to come back tomorrow. Well, if it's all hopeless, no. So, is there any artists here? Good. So, okay, even for the non-artists, if somebody asks you to paint a picture of a lake, you know, you'd probably take like blue and just make it a solid blue, right? Because that would be water, right? No, not exactly. Right? If you saw a decent painting on a wall, and you're looking at a picture of a lake, what you see is the reflection of the mountains around the lake and the trees in the water. So that which you cannot see, that which is transparent to you, is portrayed to you by its by the reflection of what's around it. Right? This page 52 gives me a palette, a spiritual palette, to look at my life out here and see the reflection, a picture of that transparent spiritual condition, right? And it makes it not so transparent anymore. It gives me an idea of what my spiritual condition looks like, right? And yes, it's in the front of the book, but just because it's something that you've already read and already have gotten to the place where you maybe read it and say, oh, I don't have that stuff in my life, right? My experience is, after almost 22 years of doing this, is it comes back. You know, discomfort in these areas come back. Maybe after I've done it for a couple more years, that won't be the case, but I don't think so. Right? It explained to me the idea, though, that this is a spiritual program for people with a spiritual problem, and this shows me what my spiritual condition is, right? And what I have to see is this is the second half of step one, right? And I have to understand that the spiritual malady sets up the condition conducive for the alcoholic insanity to return. The obsessions return and I drink again. Doesn't matter what's going on in your mind, because I was drinking, telling myself I shouldn't drink. Right? I've been sober telling myself I should drink and I couldn't. Right? Let go of the idea that the problem centers in your mind. Right? Your problem is spiritual. And your mind is dragged around. It's going to be directed by that. Right? If you're in a good spiritual place, it doesn't matter what your mind is thinking. Right? You can't drink. If you're in a poor spiritual place, then this stuff will be obvious in your life, right? And it's a warning sign that you're not in fit spiritual condition. Time does not save you from that. You know, the proof is around us. It's one of the advantages of the program is that you get to see people with time not stay sober, right? I'm not saying I'm glad they did. I'm just saying, you know, we need to see that. Just staying sober never kept me sober. Right? You know, You know the times when you're driving down the street and someone turns left in front of you, right? And you don't even miss a beat on the radio, right? Don't even think twice about that person that almost killed you. Right? The next day, same intersection. Might not be the same guy, but someone turns left in front of you, and your hand's out the window telling him he's number one. Right? What changed? Nothing out here, but something inside changed. Right? And it's spiritual. And I'm illustrating the effect that my spiritual condition has on my mind. Right? So that's what I have to see to go along with the idea that I have to have a spiritual solution for this. Right? And the experience for step one is not that you can't drink again. That's not it. The experience for step one is there's nothing stopping you from drinking again if this is as much as you're gonna, if this is as far as you're gonna go. Right? That we will drink again if we, with the truth of the problem, it's not. It was never enough for me to stop. Right? Just knowing that I have a spiritual solution doesn't give me more ability to turn to God to save me from this situation. Right? Because the other situation that was going on for me that was really important was I came into this program complete atheist. Right? Okay, you've convinced me that I'm going to drink again if I don't get something more, but, you know, how do we get move beyond this point now? Okay, you've convinced me I can drink again, right? And it's to the extent that I'm clear on that truth about step one, that I get moved into step two, being able to go along with the idea that I need a power greater than myself to change what's going on in my life, to restore me to sanity. I have to see this insanity in my life and how there's no escape from it except if I get something more from this program. I don't have the power to stop this from happening. And the process pushes me forward, pushes me along with it. Right? I come to step two out of desperation, not out of virtue, not because I want to be spiritual, not because I know what God is. I don't necessarily, at this point in the beginning, I didn't even necessarily believe in God yet. But I start to believe a little less in my own ability to change this in my own life. And and that desperation, I think, is a critical part of the program. It's a critical part of our spiritual path. I'm sure that I'm not alone with the agnostic temperament, right? I can't even stay out of agnostic behavior, right? And the idea that just because I see step one that all of a sudden I'm going to be open to this God thing is, it's just not that simple, right? But when you look at it, even though I came to this thing completely doubting the idea that there would be any kind of power that would work in my life, right? It was through seeing the desperation in my life before I even got here that took me to the place in my life where I after this, all these trips to the liquor store, telling myself I got to stop doing this, really realizing I was trapped in this way of life that I absolutely couldn't get out of, what happened is that there was some consequences that happened with some family members after that. It left me in a worse spiritual place. It just kind of like took out that last bit of whatever I had that was holding me together. And I said, enough. I can't live like this anymore. And I dug out a 357 Magnum out of a drawer and was trying to figure out how I was going to, where people actually point these things to do, to commit suicide. And that's where my drinking took me. And it wasn't because of situations in my life, like it wasn't because wanting to commit suicide because of the marriage or the loss of business. It was totally because I couldn't live the way I was living any longer and drink with the drinking and the just everything that was around that. And I, holding this gun to my around my head, trying to figure out where I was going to point it, I wasn't afraid to kill myself. This seemed like my only solution. Therapy hadn't helped. Talking to friends hadn't helped. Their solution was, you don't want to drink anymore? Let's just go get some crack. You know, that was friends' advice. You know, I said, no. This felt like it was the only way to go. You know, and it was my only alternative to go on as I was or finish it right there. And it was just for a split second that I thought, that this thought came to my mind that it was my brother's gun. And my brother was always already on the run from the police because he had unloaded his shotgun on his friend and just took off for 20 years. And I thought, you know, my brother was the only thing that I cared about at that time. And it just, the only thought that occurred to me was, what if they think it was him that did this? Right? And the frustration of that is I couldn't even kill myself. I just looked up and just screamed, God. Right? But again, it just shows you the power of being in a place of desperation. Because that place of desperation got a non-believer to scream, God. And I didn't even know that that was the most honest prayer I might have ever made in my life. Right? There was a surrender at that point. I didn't understand it all at the time. But it was just a couple days later that I bumped into somebody, a friend from the gas station that I used to hang out with, who was definitely always, I always thought he was way worse than I was. But it was just a couple days later that, was that odd or was it God? You know, I made a surrender and then he was put back in my life. And I didn't even recognize him at first. His whole face had changed. It turns out he had gotten sober. Right? And he started to tell me how he got sober. And I was interested at first, but I was hesitant because the idea of, he offered to take me to some meetings if I was interested, and I thought, AA meetings? I said, I couldn't be that bad yet. Right? But it only took a couple days of me talking to him, saying, you know, well, what do you do? And I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting. So he took me to my first meeting. Right, and if you would have talked to me about that being God in my life back then, I would have fought you on it. In fact, the whole ride home, he tried to explain the program to me, and he mentioned spiritual program, and you know that was it. I was gone. I was angry at that point, and. You hear a lot of that in the program. It's like, don't mention God because it'll scare people away. Right? But what I was taught and what I really believe is that the idea of the talk of God might scare people away, but alcohol will bring them back if they really have a problem. Right? And that was sort of my case, is although I absolutely didn't want to get caught in some kind of religious organization, you know, I was a dead man. I absolutely did not want to continue living as I was living. And I knew that I couldn't stop drinking on my own. And I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting. And started taking me to some meetings. And I stayed sober from that point on. And it's pretty miraculous that the biggest miracle in my life happened February the 23rd of 1989, where before that I was ready to blow my brains out because I couldn't stop drinking whiskey. And I show up at an AA meeting and never drink again. And that was without even owning a book yet, right? There was definitely something bigger going on than the book, the meetings, and the steps, right? And I came in contact with that first part of the power of a succession of different levels of that power entering my life. And they say that you only can absorb as much as your backside can take. So you've been sitting for a while, and you're probably ready to go home. As you know, I'll be back here at 9 o'clock, and we'll start with kind of a recap and then step two. So I hope to see a lot of you back tomorrow. And I hear the weather's going to be conducive for people to be inside tomorrow. although it's really cooperating since I've been here. It's been really nice, so I feel really lucky. So, again, thanks for spending the evening with me.